Hey, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our first Friday lunch meeting of this term. Delighted to have as our speaker Antonios Xanakopoulos, who first appeared on my radar when he wrote a brilliant study on disobeying the Security Council. Still not sure I buy the ultimate argument, but the technical level competence and skill is absolutely amazing. You may have seen him recently on social media, giving lectures, small lectures, small talks on a variety of topics. He does pretty much everything within international law, proper generalist, I guess. And we are delighted to have him here, Antonios, please.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I suppose I need to use the microphone, right?
Yeah, because we're online as well.
All right. Well, great honor to be starting the year for the other place. It's very nice to be invited. So thanks to Jan, thanks to the Lauterpacht Center, and everyone at Cambridge for the invitation. And thanks for that also very kind introduction. Jack of all trades, master of none, I suppose you call it, in other words. And also for praising the technical skill. Being technically correct is being my finest kind of being correct. So even if you don't buy the argument. All right. So the title is a little bit maybe provocative or maybe not well thought out, some Marxist insights for international law, what that might even mean. Another way actually we could have titled this is the international legal order coming to an end? There's apparently that's sort of like en vogue today. That's like what we all talk about. And basically, I thought that I'd rather structure the talk around that while taking some pieces from a particular paper that I've written on Marxist insights for international law. And it's sort of taking the initiative from Mark Carney's speech in a couple of days ago. And I don't know how many, I see some of you nodding. It was like, yeah, we heard all about that. Which I found quite shocking, truly, because it sort of like lifts the veil. It basically says, oh, yeah, this, what is it that they call it now? The international rules-based order. I have no idea what that means. It can't mean something good. But he basically sort of like lifted the veil and simply said, we always knew that was sort of like to some extent a sham. And now that we're on the receiving end of the sham, we need to resist it. I'm like, oh, well, welcome, Mark Carney, to the side of the oppressed. It's not nice being on the receiving end of the whole thing, is it? But in reality, the way to go about this is to ask sort of where is all this worry about, oh, I won't use the term international rules-based order because I don't know what it means, but I will use the term international law. And you hear all those talks, so international, like people come to you and say, what are you all about? What are you even doing? And I've had people in college tell me things like that in the last few days and weeks, and generally after the second election of Trump, or aren't you out of a job yet? You know, that kind of thing. On the one hand, and then on the other hand, you get all the international lawyers turning around and saying, we need to defend the international legal order. We need to do sort of do this. We need to do that. And I'm like, first of all, who the hell is we, right? I never know who is it, the we that we need to defend international law. Is it we the peoples? Is it we the international lawyers? Is it we who we exactly? And why is it up to international lawyers to defend international law? But the other thing is international law really under attack? Because I don't see international law being under attack. What I see is particular rules of international law being under attack. The law is not under attack at all. And we can take all sorts of like recent incidents. But perhaps before I go there, so I was thinking, you know, we can discuss Venezuela, we can discuss Greenland, we can discuss Chagos even back on vogue now after Trump said Keir Starmer is an idiot for trying to make a deal and so on. But I thought I would try to provide some structure before I pick up those questions in an attempt to show that the international legal order isn't under attack. It's a particular emanation or a particular content of international legal order that is under attack. The system is here and it's very well and is working exactly as intended in a way. And that is not under attack at all. But in order to sort of structure thoughts about that, and I promise I will not talk for long and I will not go too deep into the theory. I'll just make a few points and then we'll open it up to discussion. Let's start with the structure of the international legal relation, right? The international legal form. What do we mean by that term and how is it structured? So, as in any standard textbook, and the whole point about Marxist insights for international law is how it takes a little bit of Marxist theory, especially Pasukanish, that kind of thing, and apply it to basic concepts of international law as you will find them in any undergraduate course. So, what's sort of like the first part of any undergraduate course that you know, you open any book? The first whole point is who are the subjects of the law, right? So, if we look at the structure of the international legal form, of the international legal relation, then we can say first thing is the subject of the international legal relation. Who's the subject of the international legal relation? And this applies as much to domestic law as it does to international law, which is that effectively what we're dealing with here is what the law does is to essentially flatten out everything into the legal subjects. But it's equality of freedom. As you know, public international law, oh, if you're a state, then you're sovereign. Nobody knows what that means. Let's just say it means la plénitude de pouvoir, right? You have all the power. Okay, if you have all the power, then everybody else also had all the power. So you're all equal. And that's the concept of sovereign equality, right? But as Mark Carney will tell you today, well, that's not quite true, is it? So this legal equality isn't anything but, right, a way to disguise the factual inequality between the legal subjects. And it is like that both in international law and in domestic law. As I tell my undergraduate students when they come in and they say, oh, this whole international law and what's the point and this, that, and the other thing. I'm like, okay, good luck suing Jeff Bezos. Right? Or good luck not accepting the terms and conditions of Apple when you turn on your notebook or your iPad or whatever it is that you have. I mean, what are you going to tell them? Yes, you're free and equal, and you are free to make that contract. But are you really? So are you going to call up Apple and say, well, actually, term 3.2.1, I have a bit of an amendment there because I'm not sure that I want you to use my data in this way. They're going to be saying, well, in the exercise of your freedom and equality, you are free not to accept this contract. And then you're like, ah, yeah. Or in a similar term, you're free not to accept an offer of a job and die under a bridge without any food too. A bit populist, people would say. But it is what it is, right? So why is it any different between states? In reality, it is exactly the same between states. We have this type of formal legal equality, and that's sort of like the legal reality. And then we have the real reality, which is that states are not at all free and equal in any way, shape, or form. And you can going back to Mark Carney, is basically what you were saying is, I thought we were on the side of the powerful. And for as long as we were on the side of the powerful, we didn't have particular problem with interventions here and there, right? As long as it's the weird brown people that this is done to, that's absolutely fine. But now you're turning against the civilized West President Trump, and how dare you do that to us? We are white and civilized, right? You can't be doing that. You can pull that stuff off in Venezuela or wherever. When you start sort of like using coercive measures against Canada by using tariffs or trying to take over Greenland through the use of tariffs, that's coercion that we won't stand for, except for when we do it to others, that's fine. The subject of the legal relation is one point. So that legal equality behind which we have that factual inequality. I'm not saying that it doesn't help equalize to a certain extent, right? So there is a positive side to this as well. But the negative side is overwhelming and it's structural. And that's the important thing. And I'll come back. If we look at the object of the legal relation, in a way, I'm going to be sort of super cynical and super reductive here. The object of the legal relation is, in reality, property. That's all that it is about. The whole point of not just international law, but effectively of all law, is to protect property. Now, you will, and I don't mean this in the crass way of sort of idiotic people coming over to you and saying, "Oh, yet you have an iPhone," or something like that. We're not talking about that kind of property. We're talking about property of means of production. We're talking, and when we say means of production, which is a very cool Marxist way of saying basically nature, technology, labor power, right? Who had the ownership of the means by which we can produce anything to make a living? It's the same thing in domestic law and international law. If you think about it, the whole object of the legal relation is to protect property of this kind of means of production for a particular dominant class, even through the lens of the state. So if you think about it, title to territory, right? The whole discussion. Where do we start? Oh, the territory of the state. How the state is sovereign over its territory, territories inviolable, and so on and so forth, right? But it's not just territory, it goes beyond territory. It goes beyond territory on a number of levels. Resources, right? From colonialism to what is essentially colonialism today, which is investment law in reality, this all comes down to that kind of protection of property. Even if you think about it, things like human rights. Again, I'm being very quick and very crass. There is a paper, you can read it and disagree. But think about human rights. Everyone's like, "Oh, human rights, isn't that wonderful?" And da da da, and little hearts, and the whole thing. Where does human rights come from? It comes essentially from the bourgeois revolutions of the late 18th century, which are then translated into the International Law for the Protection of Aliens. And the International Law for the Protection of Aliens is nothing but the protection of the white man's property in the weird, uncivilized brown areas that he, because it's invariably he, goes to in order to basically extract the resources, if you think about it. And starting from that protection of property, then you have everything else that you are required to have in order to enjoy your property. Like, for example, what's the first thing that you need to have in order to be able to enjoy your property properly? Anyone?
Police.
Well, even before the police,
Your life.
your life, right? The life. You need to have, first of all, you need to be alive in order to be able to enjoy your property. Then you also need to be, to have freedom, liberty, and security of the person. Right? So you're not thrown in jail or sort of like not taken hostage or something like that. You need to also have a legal system to protect that property. So no denial of justice. Does all of this sound familiar? And originally, this is just for the alien, what we today call the investor. But back then, we called the alien, right? It's only after the Second World War that this starts being extended to everyone. And even then, only with respect to particular rights, which are sometimes called negative rights, as in, oh, these are rights where we demand the state not enter into, right? These are rights where the state basically needs to stay away from. And that's why we can protect them, because that's cheap. As opposed to positive rights, like, for example, economic, social, and cultural rights, which are very expensive to guarantee that you have a right to a home, to clean water, to a livable environment, to health, to anything like that. That's way too expensive. So we can't really protect that, which is, of course, not true, because even the negative, so-called negative rights, in reality, they do require the police. They do require a court system. They do require all sorts of state mechanisms in order to guarantee them, right? They have positive aspects. We tend to forget that when we talk about them. Sorry, I'm getting on too long about rights. Anyway, you get the point, I think, right? So the object of illegal, I could go on and talk about the concept of the area, right? The whole idea of how this sort of like there was an attempt. We talk about freedom of the seas, right? I don't know if anybody's doing law of the sea, but you know what I tell my students, whenever you hear freedom, run, right? Somebody, it's not going to be your freedom, or it will be if you're very rich, but if you aren't, it's not your freedom. So freedom of the seas means what? It means basically everybody has the right. Let's take the old rule, 3 nautical mile territorial sea. It means that Japan has as much of a right to fish 4 miles off the coast of Equatorial Guinea as Equatorial Guinea has to fish 4 miles off the coast of Japan. Except that's bullshit. Right? In very simple terms, because Japan is a technologically advanced, rich, powerful state that has a distant water fishing fleet that can go around the world and fish off the coast of Equatorial Guinea any day. Whereas Equatorial Guinea, what are they going to do? And especially what were they going to do like in the 60s and the 70s? Get into their wooden boats and paddle over to Japan. So, of course, you have an equal right, but is it really an equal right? When newly independent states coming out of colonialism sort of during the negotiation of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, so 1973, 1982, in the context of also the new economic, the new international economic order, tried to push for something different when they were discussing the international seabed. They said, we don't want this to belong to nobody and be free like the high seas. We want this to belong to everybody, right? We want to share it. We want this to be a common heritage of humankind. And they had the number. They had the numbers. And they formally won. As in, today the area is the common heritage of humankind and all the rest of it. But the problem is, the system will not let you legislate communism. It doesn't work that way. So if, in case you know what happened, right, 1982, the convention is made with the concept of the common heritage of humankind. It has very, very complicated provisions for technology sharing, for sharing of proceeds, and so on and so forth. You wait for 12 years to get the required ratifications. You come up to 1994, the treaty is about to enter into force, and it has precisely how many Western states ratifying it? Take a wild guess.
Four.
One, the very powerful state of Iceland, watching the news these days. And I do mean Iceland rather than saying Iceland, right? Of course, that means the convention will be non-viable. If you don't have any Western states participating, and especially for a convention that provides for a number of institutions, including for the international seabed, right? You need the authority. You need the enterprise. You're creating a new court, the International Tribunal for the Law of the Sea, and so on and so forth. Who's going to pay for all that stuff? So, what do you do? What you do is you make an agreement on the interpretation of Part 11 on the deep seabed, which means basically you get rid of most of the provisions with respect to sharing. There is no way that it's an example of how difficult it is to use the law, right? To sort of like overcome a structural relation that the law itself co-constitutes and is there to maintain. It's very, very hard to do. Picking and choosing, let me leave this behind as well, and move to another concept. The So we talked about the subject of the legal relation. We talked about the object of the legal relation. So as we're looking at the structure of the legal relation, let's look at the operation of the legal relation as well. And this can be a very big chapter because it centers around the concept of coercion. Law is a coercive order. That is the general idea, right? The whole point is that a rule is a command backed by some sort of sanction, by some sort of sanction that is coercive, right? That means something is happening to you, whether you like it or not. May happen to you. It doesn't always happen to you. When I park illegally, I always get a ticket. When my friend George parks illegally, he never gets a ticket. He's just lucky it happens. That doesn't mean there isn't a coercive sanction, right? Just because he got lucky. True story, by the way. I don't know how he does. And this is what creates a particular problem. I mean, it's the same in domestic law, but it creates a particular problem in a decentralized legal order like the international legal order, where basically most coercion, but where coercion is baked into the system in the sense of essentially countermeasures, the reaction to illegality, right? The reaction to illegality is basically decentralized coercive activity because the way that it works is a violation in response to a violation. State A violates the law towards state B. State B can call upon that state sort of like sees the violation if it is continuing, offer assurances and guarantees of non-repetition, offer reparation, right? Standard state responsibility stuff. Okay, what happens if state A doesn't do that? Well, all that state B can do, but also something that state B can do, is to take countermeasures, right? To violate in response to that violation. Plus, state B also retains the power at any moment to do any number of things that are unfriendly but perfectly lawful. What we know as retortion, right? You're familiar with the concept of retortion, or do I need to withdrawal of voluntary aid, even breaking off diplomatic relations, the road in front of the Russian embassy in London being renamed Kiev Road. The first ones who did that was the Glasgow City Council, who renamed the square of the South African consulate during apartheid into Nelson Mandela Square, so that all the diplomats from South Africa had to cross Nelson Mandela Square to get into their consulate. That kind of thing. So perfectly lawful but unfriendly act, which of course allows quite a bit of economic coercion. If you don't have an obligation not to have tariffs, then of course you can impose whatever tariffs you want. That's not unlawful. It's in fact, states have been doing it for the longest time. And even those things that might be unlawful in terms of economic coercion or other forms of coercion may be justifiable as countermeasures, right? So coercion is baked into the system. And of course, in a decentralized legal order, coercion is mostly available to those who have the power to impose such coercive measures in the sense that they can deal with the cost for imposing such coercive measures, because these things come with cost. But it's a different thing bearing that cost if you're the United States, or if you're the European Union, or even if you're China, and it's a different thing bearing that cost if you are, I don't know, the Congo, right? So there we have covered to a certain extent the structure of the legal relation. What this explains is basically everybody sort of like going nuts about, oh my God, Trump, he's using coercion to do all those things. Coercion, by the way, you might say, well, but coercion in international law is prohibited. No. I mean, there are provisions that refer to coercion, but if you look at any one of them, the only way that coercion is defined is as threat or use of force. Because economic coercion is perfectly allowed. That's the whole point. It always was. Economic coercion is perfectly allowable in domestic law as well. Go and try and get a job. You are less powerful than your employer. Your employer is going to say, this is the salary. Would you like to negotiate it? And you're like, yes, I would. Except you can't. I mean, you can try. You can become a member of a union and then you have a better shot, but not in this country after Thatcher. So that's cool. You get the idea. So what he's doing right now, sort of like imposing random tariffs on Denmark or threatening to impose tariffs on Denmark, threatening to impose tariffs on the rest of the European Union in order to force them to sort of like cede Greenland and so on and so forth, it's objectionable. But strictly speaking, who has told us that this is unlawful? What is unlawful is threatening force, right? That would be unlawful coercion. But making a treaty, right? Imagine the situation where they come to some sort of agreement on the basis of economic coercion only without the threat of use of force, then that would not be invalid under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. In fact, that happens all the time. When that happened to Greece, for example, during the Greek sovereign debt crisis, nobody was like, oh my God, they're being coerced. Isn't that invalid under the Vienna Convention? No. It's perfectly fine. It's objectionable on all sorts of other levels, but it's actually legally perfectly fine. As long as you don't threaten to bomb them, it's okay. And even that is sort of like quickly disappearing now, and I'll come back to it. I mean, it's been disappearing for decades, but only now do we realize how this is sort of like accelerating. So we've dealt with the structure of the legal relation. You throw something at me when I need to stop. I'll make two quick points and we'll stop from that. So we've dealt with the structure of the legal relation. So subject, object, and content, and operation. Let's look at the content of the legal relation. This comes down to interpretation. It's also something that is extremely, extremely important. There are all these sort of like tons of ink have been spilled about people writing on interpretation, this, that, the other thing, the Vienna Convention, and all that stuff. You look at the Vienna Convention, Article 31, what does it say? A treaty is to be interpreted in good faith in accordance with the ordinary meaning to be given to the terms in their context and in light of the treaty's object and purpose, which basically means nothing. It means literally nothing. This is exactly what we say in all domestic law. And in all domestic law, it means equally nothing. Because all that it tells you is, in order to interpret inherently indeterminate to a larger or smaller extent terms, what you need to do is to read the text, textual interpretation, in context, contextual interpretation, in light of the object and purpose, teleological, right, purpose of interpretation. And then Article 32 says, and in order to confirm, you can go to the preparatory works, right, which is historical interpretation. But it doesn't tell you how. It doesn't tell you how much text, how much context, how much object and purpose, how much history should I put in? I mean, what good is a recipe where somebody tells you, oh, you need meat, oil, onions, and turmeric. And you're like, okay, but how much? Oh, the IT says, if you just throw it all in a crucible and something will come out. Now, that is a recipe, but what this is a recipe for is a recipe for disaster, right? What am I trying to say with this? That prescribes some outer limits of interpretation, but they're very vast outer limits within which you find a lot of plausible interpretations. And there are these sort of like theorists of the law who will tell you, I have the way to find the one true meaning using the tool that the Vienna Convention gives me or whatever interpretive theory gives me. I will dig through the ground and come up with the one true meaning of this particular provision, which of course there isn't one. That is the whole point. There are more or less plausible meanings, but whether they're more or less plausible doesn't actually depend on the law. And the law doesn't tell you anything about whether they are more or less plausible. They are essentially political decisions. Political in the very broad term, right? I don't want to take this to Robert Sapolsky and sort of like, it's all determined by whether your faraway ancestors from like 100,000 years ago were pastoralists or people living in the desert. Or people living in jungles, nor am I trying to say, do I want to take it back to it might be ethical, and in that sense, it's not political and all that stuff. Essentially, it is political in the final analysis. It is predetermined by your conscious biases, your unconscious biases, your political position, the way that you grew up, and so on and so forth. All that the law does, and this is not me, this is Kelsen, right? A positivist, if there ever was one, is to tell you who is the one who gets to make the political decision of choosing the authoritative interpretation from among the plausible interpretations. So interpretation is inherently political, and it's the same in all law, whether it is domestic or international, but it's very, very clear in international law as well. And you can see it, not just in the decisions of the International Court of Justice, the inconsistencies, and we can get into all that if we, and I wish we had time. You can see it if you compare sort of like WTO appellate body, may it rest in peace, as opposed to sort of like European Court of Human Rights, right? Where the, you get anything into the appellate body and they're like, is Sochu like whiskey? They have to be like products. Oxford English Dictionary, like means. That's what they do, right? Like it's a whole ton of text, and then maybe they'll take into consideration some context and some object and purpose. Whereas you go to the European Court of Human Rights, like, well, the convention is meant to guarantee rights that are effective and not rights that are illusory. So we might forget about the end in that sentence. So yes, text, but yeah, no. There's a lot more object and purpose. So you see how this operates. And this is all lege artis interpretation under the Vienna Convention. You can't say, oh, the one court is wrong and the other is right. One final thing, I'm throwing a lot of things out there and then we can discuss them. We've dealt with the structure of the legal relation, we've dealt with the content of the legal relation, and we can discuss this in a lot of detail if you want. But let me also talk a little bit about the justification of the legal relation. And the justification of the legal relation is what, in Marxism, you would simply call ideology, right? And I'll give you a very simple example of that. I was doing an undergraduate lecture the other day, like literally on Tuesday or whenever it was. And I don't remember what we were discussing. We were discussing something about law in general. There was a, it was meant to be on jurisdiction. And I was talking about jurisdiction. And then somehow, like one of the students turned around and said, but the law can also sort of help you sort of like be free. And for example, it enables you to have a salary. Contract law enables you to have a salary. And I'm like, do you realize what you just said? Like the law enables me to have a salary. But this is the operation of ideology. You are so conditioned, right? To think that it is absolutely common sense that we should own nothing but our hands and brains, that's base and legs, that's basically it, that the means of production, that nature, technology, anything will be privately owned by very, very few individuals, and that all that we have is our labor power to sell, and we are enabled to do so by contract law. So we should be actually grateful that this is the situation, rather than be like, who the hell made that guy, right? That it had not occurred to him. And this is how ideology operates, right? It all of a sudden, certain things have become common sense and you're not allowed to question them. Because if you question them, you're loony left. Like this guy is loony, right? These things will never happen. But as Nelson Mandela used to say, things will never happen until they happen. So breaking free from that chain of ideology, or at least trying to question it to a certain extent, is very, very helpful. And in a very, very peculiar way and very dangerous way, what the United States is doing today is doing precisely that. It is allowing you to question the common sense of what had been happening so far. Now, of course, this can go two ways, and it's far more likely to go one way, the bad way, than it is to go the good way, simply because there is no organization in terms of taking it the good way. And that is a very, very big problem. But this, in a way, it sort of brings everything to a close in giving you a basic structure of certain sort of like Marxist concepts that you can draw out of, not so much Marx himself, even though there is quite a lot in that too, but from other theorists, and use them in the way that you think about international law, at least to illuminate some aspects. This all comes down in the end to a very, very big question, which is, as lawyers, what are we supposed to do with the law, right? Is the law, is it, are we able to do anything with it, or is it just something absolutely sort of like forsaken that we can't use, that we shall just hope the revolution will come and then it will wither and die along with the state, as Marx famously said. Or is there something that we, or is there some emancipatory potential in the law? That's sort of like the big fight. I'm sort of in the middle, like a proper sort of like revisionist sitting on the fence, because there are people, like there's this a very well-known guy, to me at least, China Miéville. I don't know if you've read China Miéville. He's fantastic. Okay, can disagree with lots of things. But basically, he wrote his PhD, which was on a Marxist theory of international law. He did a lot of Pasukanis, and in the end, he's like, all of this is useless. So he wrote the book, published it, and then threw it away and continued writing his science fiction, which is for what he's really known to the non-nerds, or to a whole different kind of nerds than we are. So that's one side. And then there's another side of all these people say, oh, no, we must defend international law because there is emancipatory potential and so on and so forth. In reality, I'm a little bit in the middle in the sense of, yes, the law is good for basically rear guard actions. Like at most, what we're trying to do is prevent further slippage and potentially sort of like make small ingress here and there. But it will never help you for anything more. Like it literally is the master's tool, and you can never use the master's tools to bring down the master's house. Like you can prevent slippage, you can fight rear guard actions, but it's something that we're not even doing today, if you think about it. So you have the invasion of Venezuela. For me, that's the most shocking thing. And then people start debating, oh, is this lawful or unlawful? I'm like, seriously? I mean, yes, okay, plausible interpretations, but really, guys, I mean, this is, I mean, in terms of unlawfulness, this pretty much beats it, right? There was not even an attempt to justify it. But of course, that doesn't matter because international law changes through the practice and opinion years of states. And if you have this kind of fight, as we know, but from Nicaragua, whether something is lawful or unlawful, in the right, in the end, whether something is a violation or an exception, depends really on the reaction of other states. What was the reaction of other states? It was Keir Starmer coming out to one of his ministers basically saying it's not the United Kingdom's position to sit in judgment of other states. And I'm like, what? That is the whole point. Like you were sitting in judgment of Russia and you did well. Like not even 2 years ago, you sit in judgment of everyone. And all of a sudden, you don't sit in judgment of that simply because you don't want to condemn. But if you don't condemn, what does that mean? You accept. Or the Greek prime minister, he was the other fantastic guy who tweeted, it is not the time, this is not the time to discuss the legality of the recent actions. And I'm like, when is the time, prime minister? When do you think might be a good time to discuss? So we're not even preventing slippage. Slippage is accelerating, right? So let me, on this happy note, let me put it to rest. I hope it wasn't too all over the place for you. It was supposed to be sort of like a bird's eye view. And open up the discussion. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.